welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 287 of the podcast. And it is the 18th of September, 2016, as I record this. So today I have an interview with Janet Murray, and we're talking all about how to get PR for your book and your author brand. Now, I have definitely had a bit of an issue with PR in the past. Way back when I first started in 2007, 2008, I got onto national TV and national radio and in the national newspapers with my first self-published book and just barely sold any books at all. So since then, I've steered myself away from PR because getting ROI, actual return on investment, is much easier with things like BookBub and Facebook ads and other things like mailing lists, where you can directly track your book sales based on the money you're spending. So, but I wanted to bring Janet to you because Janet has a book out about how to get PR yourself. So by telling a story about you and your life that relates to your book. And I want to grow my JF Pen brand in 2017. So I was really interested in what she talks about. And, you know, because if you do it yourself, then you don't have to spend thousands of dollars on hiring a PR company. And that is where many authors make mistakes. So I hope you'll find this interview interesting. I certainly did. And I've got Janet's book here, and it's well worth the much smaller investment in terms of getting your own PR. So I hope you'll find it interesting. Okay, so into publishing news, and there were quite a lot of things that caught my eye this week. First of all, The Guardian reported that Kickstarter is now one of the publishing's big five. It did 2,967 literary projects, whereas Simon & Schuster, the smallest of the big four, does just over 2,000 titles annually. So it was really interesting because, of course, all the Kickstarter books are self-published. And I think we've seen reports before that if you put self-publishing as a bucket, it would definitely compete with some of the big publishing houses. So that's really interesting. Second, the FT, Financial Times, announced that the EU Commission, now this might sound a bit dry, but this is important because this is about your money, people. The EU Commission has decided that ebooks are actually books rather than electronically supplied services. So what happened back at the end of 2014, what was the first of, I think it was the 31st of December 2014, is that VAT in the EU came into effect for ebooks because they were considered electronically supplied services. There is no VAT or sales tax on print, and there's all this different VAT on ebooks. And now the EU has said, okay, actually they're books. And you can imagine that the publishers are like, no, you can't start charging VAT on print. So therefore the VAT must come down on ebooks and digital newspapers. And so I would expect that this would happen in 2017. However, obviously once a tax is applied, it's very difficult for them to claw, like to change it again, because of course the government like to get more money from taxes rather than less. But I think this is really interesting. So there are some people who don't think this affects them, but this affects all authors because it is about where the customer lives, not the author. So US authors, yes, your royalties are affected by this EU law, as are authors all over the world. So it's about where the customer is. So if you have your books on Amazon, then you are selling to the EU countries, therefore you are affected by VAT. Kobo, Amazon, iBooks, they all have to deal with this VAT. Now, they deal with it, so you don't have to, but it means you get less money, so your royalties are less. And again, this is for all authors. And I'm talking to you, Jim Cookwell, at the Sell More Book Show. And I know he doesn't listen, but Brian does. because Jim always says, oh, but it's only for EU authors. No, it is for all authors who sell to customers in the EU. So anyway, I'm really happy about this. I just don't understand why they thought ebooks were different to books in the first place. And I actually, there was a consultative process, one of these really difficult to figure out questionnaires, but I did the questionnaire. So I'm really happy about this because I probably wrote about 2000 words to the EU Commission about why ebooks are actually books. So I feel very justified and happy about this report, and we'll hope to see our royalties go up again in 2017. Also, there was a hilarious article, well, I find it hilarious anyway, about one of the Booker Prize nominees, Otessa Moshfegh, who also won the Penn Hemingway Debut Novel Award. So she's a sort of literary darling at the moment. However, all the links are in the show notes as ever. But, the Booker Prize is one of the most prestigious literary prizes in the world. It's taken very, very seriously. And the authors who are normally interviewed about this type of nomination are very serious. And I'm going to quote from the article. Otessa says, it was a deliberate exercise in playing with the format of commercial fiction to get the attention of a big publisher. I didn't want to wait 30 years to be discovered. And then she says this, because there are all these morons making millions of dollars, so why not me? I'm smart and talented and motivated and disciplined. So I went out and bought a book called The 90-Day Novel by Alan Watt. It started out as a joke, but I'm broke and I want to be famous. It was that kind of a gesture. Now, I find this really funny. And then because she says at the end, the Booker people will be disgusted with her revealing the origins. And the book is called Eileen, and Moshfegh is spelled Moshfegh. And I'll link to this article in the show notes. But I find this really fascinating. One, because she actually bought the 90-day novel by Alan Watt, which I have, and I've been through, and I haven't written a literary nominee, well, she's already won a prize. So I find this hilarious. I'm also really kind of slightly impressed by her attitude. I think very few of us have this kind of attitude. I wonder also whether it's sort of played out for the media thing. But as we've also seen in the last couple of weeks, if you might have missed Lionel Shriver making lots of comments in Australia that have really offended a lot of people around cultural appropriation. And I do wonder sometimes if these authors sort of go out their way to be offensive so that they get more press. And I find it funny because I don't think she'll win the Booker Prize now. I think if she was in contention, she's not anymore. They can't have someone win the Booker Prize who just picked up the 90-day novel by Alan Watt. But anyway, I think it's interesting because so many people talk about that there's a distinction between literary and genre fiction, or literary and crime, or, you know, that there's this line between best-selling novels that are written according to plans like the 90-day novel and literary fiction. But this is somebody who's taken a classic commercial genre approach and written something that the Booker Prize judges like. So very interesting. And to follow on from this, and I know I've got lots of news this week, but very interesting, I have read on your behalf The Bestseller Code, the book that has launched in the UK this week and in America next week, a book that basically reports on a machine learning study on how to make a bestseller. However, I read it yesterday, and it doesn't have that much in for authors. It seems more like an extended sales pitch to publishing houses, and I fully expect that Amazon or someone is going to buy their algorithm or whatever it is and use their, or at least the publishing houses will use their service for manuscripts. But there are a few things that I wanted to pull out which I thought were interesting. First of all, The Da Vinci Code and 50 Shades of Grey had exactly the same story curve in terms of the emotional ups and downs, except for the ending. Da Vinci Code is an up ending, 50 Shades of Grey is a down ending because it has a sequel. But you know what they didn't really explain is it's exactly the same curve as the arch plot from the three-act structure that every screenwriting book teaches. Now, what I think is interesting is it really does look like The Da Vinci Code and 50 Shades of Grey were plotted books as opposed to pantsed books. So I think that's the most interesting thing from that. They pointed out that Danielle Steele and John Grisham write the most perfect stories, the most perfect blockbuster bestseller stories, and that focusing their niche is a key part. quote, one topic that is overwhelmingly part of their brand. There is an implied contract with the reader based on the author name. And this is a lot of the focus on one niche type of advice. So Danielle Steele does family drama, women's issues. John Grisham obviously does legal drama. So I thought that was interesting. And certainly people know when they pick up a Danielle Steele what they're going to get. They know what they're going to get with Grisham, mostly. He's done a couple of other things that haven't done very well because probably they weren't legal. But this is interesting because as indies, you know, one of the big pieces of advice is focus on one niche, focus one author name on one brand. And yes, some authors have gone outside of that. But an author like Bob Mayer, who's written probably near 70 books now, and he's said on his blog before that one of his regrets is not focusing on one niche earlier on in his career. So I think that's really interesting. Also, books that have a high human closeness or connection level do well. And again, not a surprise there then. People like reading about people. So if you have human connection in your books, then they'll do well. Then they actually write off a whole section of books, which is where a lot of indies sit. They say underperforming topics include all things otherworldly and fantastical. They write off anything fantasy or supernatural, talking about Harry Potter and Game of Thrones as being outliers. But they only were really measuring the mainstream blockbuster books. And of course, they didn't measure any indie superstars who might be on Amazon only. But this does explain why my literary agent keeps saying, why don't you write a thriller that doesn't have supernatural or paranormal stuff in? And I don't know if I'm capable of doing that. So yeah, but I thought that was interesting. I don't know how they explain Twilight either, but I think they looked at a very specific group of books. And so again, you know, all of these reports, they look at something very specific. Then there was some, there was one interesting section on the type of writing that occurs in blockbuster books. So opening the book with a sentence that states the truth of the novel in some way and encapsulates the plot. Easier said than done, but they have some interesting examples. Using contractions like don't instead of do not, and using words like okay, the word thing occurs 6 times more often in blockbuster books. Now, they overarchingly describe this as writing in the language of how people actually speak. Which I think is really, really true. If you look, well, the average reading age of the mass market is much lower than the average reading age of a literary publishing house. So this is, and that's not meant to be offensive to anyone, that is, most people would rather read in an easy language without big words. So that's interesting. Words like okay occur a lot more. Also, periods or full stops are more common in blockbusters, not colons, semicolons, and they say that many of the most best-selling authors were previously journalists, not MFAs. So they were trained in a style that appeals to the public, not critics. And of course, that also means shorter sentences. So I think that's really interesting. And I'm currently looking at tools like Grammarly to work with my own writing before I send it to my editor, because I think this is something I need to do better. I tend to use a lot too many commas, I think. Also, words that imply agency and acting on the world as opposed to being passive. Again, that's quite common advice. Your protagonist must act upon the world. They cannot just be lying there waiting for things to happen. And using the words need, want, miss, and love appear more in bestsellers. And this is really interesting. They actually go through Gone Girl and show how both the main characters use the words need quite a lot. And if you pick out the sentences with the word need, it really does sort of overarchingly describe the plot between Nick and Amy. So I thought that was probably the most interesting part of the book for me. They also, you know, talk about dialogue tags and using said and asked are the, you know, is the best thing. And again, that's very common advice. Don't use big words like exclaimed, or as Stephen King likes to say in On Writing, ejaculated. Don't use over the top dialogue tags. There's also an interesting discussion on titles and the girl phenomenon, and they think the girl phenomenon is not over. Personally, I think that books featuring slightly alternative women is definitely not over. But as a reader, I now actively avoid books with girl in the title because it just annoys me and they're all copycat. So this is the thing. These types of books have some interesting stuff, but they also, what are you going to do? I think what is more interesting is that there was an article in Wired that was reporting on this bestseller code book, which also brought out other companies that are doing sort of applying these types of algorithms to their actual publishing model. So one example was Inkit, I-N-K-I-T-T, and it says Inkit's algorithms examine reading patterns and engagement levels, and then for the best performers on the platform, they act as a literary agent, keeping 15% commission, which is the standard. And made me think that Wattpad should potentially look at doing something like that. And then Callisto Media, based in California, uses big data analysis to find out where there's an audience for a nonfiction book and then hire someone to write it, capturing revenue in the long tail. Now, and this is the type of nonfiction niche analysis that many of the Make Money on Kindle books have used. But this is an actual company doing micro publishing on a big scale. And I don't know how individual authors can compete against a company that's using big data analysis like that. But it is very, this whole thing is very interesting. And I think big data coming into publishing is inevitable. There are data scientists being hired by publishing companies now. And I absolutely believe that what will happen eventually is you'll be writing a novel and submitting it to a slush pile that is actually an AI that will read the book or read in the book and come out with some kind of score. And then if the score is a certain number, it will then go to a human reader. I think that is very, very likely. And I'm pretty sure that Amazon will have that built into their system as well. Should we be upset about this? I don't think so. I'm surrounded by books on screenwriting, story structure, and a whole load of other things that, in an attempt to help me write a better story. Now, if I could get access to one of these algorithms that would read in my first draft and then tell me this is how you could make this a better story, I would be fine with that. I don't think that's a big deal, because the perfect story, as I said earlier, with the Da Vinci Code and with 50 Shades, these perfect story structures, they do exist. And you know, there is a human need for this type of story. No one could say that the Da Vinci Code and 50 Shades of Grey are the same story. So what we bring to this process is not necessarily an original story structure, but the people, the characters, the settings, the plot, the interesting personal stuff that you bring to your story that will only ever be you anyway. So please don't be crazy about this type of technology. I think it will help us and that we should embrace it. And I do, however, think that chasing a bestseller is kind of pointless, because so many authors do and clearly don't make it. And then even if you do make it, and the book Big Magic is very good on this, Elizabeth Gilbert after Eat, Pray, Love was basically, told the only way is down. So are you really going to define your life by trying to get this one big book that will make you gazillions and then you can retire? It's really about thinking, why are you writing? Really, why are you writing? I mean, sure, I would like a seven-figure deal and a blockbuster movie. Absolutely, I would. But aren't we really writing because we love it and we enjoy the magic of seeing our thoughts become real on the page and the challenge of creating a book and connecting with readers? And yes, the money is nice if it comes. But, I'm just grateful we can do this at this point in history. So keep coming back to, what is your definition of success? Why are you really writing? Is it to help yourself? Because writing is so healing. Is it to connect with readers? And chasing a blockbuster, yes, I want to become a better storyteller. I do have these ambitions, but I can't define my life by just chasing after this nebulous goal. So I'll keep reading these books and reporting back to you. Let's all just keep writing and not get too upset about it all. Now, I realise that this is an enormous introduction today, but I wanted to talk about that book because it's very timely and it's all over the media right now. So I wanted to talk a bit about it. Now, on personal news, I am nearly 33,000 words into End of Days. I've been working really hard this week and I'm absolutely exhausted. It has twisted into something I wasn't expecting, and I find myself in the classic pit of self-doubt. You know, as I head towards the middle of the book, I'm really just feeling it's a pile of crap. Now, this is very common. I thought I would mention it because I think everyone feels like this. However, what I will do is carry on, and I will just continue writing that first draft, because you can only work with a draft. I mean, basically, you need a draft in order to make it better. So I am cracking on, and will be continuing with that this week. This week, I also announced my event in Brisbane, and the tickets are almost sold out. So if you want to come and to my event on February 25th, 2017 in Brisbane, Australia, go to thecreativepen.com/Brisbane2017. And I'll also be in Auckland on the 11th. And that is thecreativepen.com/Auckland2017. So very excited about that. And just one more. I'll be in London in November, and that is thecreativepen.com/NOV16, N-O-V-16. I know I should have done London 2016, but it's NOV16. So if you're interested, you can always find the links to where I'm speaking at thecreativepen.com/speaking. Okay, so thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. I love getting them, and I really love to hear what you're doing while you're listening to the show. So NT Jenks says, picking peaches while listening to the show, sent me a lovely picture of the orchard. Mitch Reinhardt, I'm still waiting for my manuscript to come back from the editor, but I've started working with a cover artist I found on your list. Awesome, I'm really pleased about that. Joanne Mallon says, I love the show, and the idea of comparing our writing to an Olympic timeline has really stuck with me. It's been a great motivator. Fantastic. Trish sent me a lovely email, and I wanted to read a bit of it because she said, listening to the show while my kids are busy catching up on their cartoons. My favourite part of the podcast is the introduction. I love hearing about what you're doing in your career. I wanted to say that although your fiction isn't my usual genre, I had to try Desecration because you talk about it was that book that you really let loose and found your voice. First chapter, I was blown away. I had tried to read Stone of Fire. It wasn't just my cup of tea, but Desecration was so very different. And it wasn't just the story. Your voice was raw and beautiful, dark and lovely. I couldn't put it down. hearing you talk about finding your voice has challenged me to relax and just write and to have faith I will find it. And I just wanted to say thank you to Trish, first of all, for trying my work. And yes, Stone of Fire is a kind of Dan Brown-esque, and that series, obviously that was my first novel as well. Desecration was my fifth. And so that's one big tip for people. If you're struggling to find your voice, I think it takes a couple of books. I'm always really thrilled when people like Desecration because it is dark. You know, that book means a lot to me because it was when I really started to relax. And yeah, so I'm so glad that encouraged you, Trish. And thank you so much for letting me know. Bethany Hensel, I love the realistic and actionable advice, and your laugh is awesome. Thank you, Bethany. J.A. Harris says, just heard the SPP podcast on mindset. Really helps to hear about the cycle of struggle for writers. Yes, I was on the self-publishing podcast last week talking about the author mindset. And Dave, if those of you who listen to the show, Dave really opened up about depression, which is pretty common. And we all got pretty raw on that show. J.A. Andrews says, listening while making jewellery, learning a lot about self-editing. Yes, lots of people liked Harry's show and enjoyed listening to his voice. Amar from My Kitab podcast in India said, taking a relaxed walk by the waterfront in beautiful Kochi, Kerala in India. I've been to Kochi. It is indeed lovely. Thank you, Amar. Connie B. Dowell, listening while playing with my son. We found chestnuts. Any conkers in the UK yet? Yes, I actually have right next to me on my desk two conkers I found yesterday, or horse chestnuts as they're called elsewhere in the world. But yes, I have my conkers. We're in conker season, which I love. And I always pick them up when I'm walking, have them in my pocket. Alicia says, I loved Harry DeWolf's ball and cup game story metaphor and your thoughts on dictation. Fantastic. Lots more. Just pick a couple more. Jack Arbor says, I for one like the extended podcast intros, which is good because today is a big one. Jessica said, morning run through Dundas, Ontario. The creative pen is my power song, which I love. I'm really happy about that. And yeah, I mean, I love being an upbeat voice in the market. It really makes me upset when people think everything's a downer when it's not. This is like the best time ever to be a writer. And finally, Jamie R. Pinriki said, listening to the podcast as I walk through my city, here's our provincial legislative building, and sent me some pictures, which is great. Okay, so you can always tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, with what you're doing while you're listening to the show. And I always love to see pictures of pets and buildings and outside and nature and whatever you're up to, or you doing whatever you're doing. I love the interaction we have on the show. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by 99 Designs. You can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. On 99 Designs, you can get all kinds of designs for your author business, including book covers, merchandising, branding, business cards, illustrations, artwork, and much more. Or of course, ad pictures as well. All kinds of things. So how does it work? So you decide on your project and then describe it and post it for all the designers to see. For example, for an ebook or print book cover or a Facebook ad image or a custom header or a custom illustration. So you need to be really specific about what you're looking for. And I would say add as much detail as you can. For example, be very specific about your genre, as a dark fantasy image versus a romance image will result in two very different books. And maybe use examples of covers you like that are best-selling in your category. Then you will post that project and you'll start getting designs. Now, it might be slow at first because people might be waiting for the first mover, or they might be actually doing the designs, and then suddenly they'll come thick and fast. And if you can make the competition public and people will riff off each other, you can also make it private and you'll get more diversity but fewer variations. You can add comments and feedback and stars, and the designers will come back with more iterations. You can also create a poll to your audience or email list. Then you decide on a short list and finally the winner. And you only pay if you're happy, and then you get the designs. And it is a super fun process, and I've done it for the custom illustrations of The Key to the Gates of Hell, which is on the front and inside the print book for Gates of Hell, one of my arcane books. And also the map of Aotearoa, New Zealand, in the front of dark fantasy novel Risen Gods, which I did with Jay Thorne. So on 99 Designs, you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Now, there are no new patrons today, but thanks to everyone who supports the show on Patreon, and it has now become significant enough that I am moving to only one commercial podcast sponsor from next month. So thank you for supporting the show, and this week I released the latest Patreon-only Q&A show, which is an extra 35 to 40 more minutes of me, as if you don't get enough already. You can get that extra audio and the whole backlist of extra audios if you become a patron for as low as $2 a month, or however much you would like to support. So you can go to patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen if you would like to support the show. Thanks to everybody. Now we better get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Janet Murray. Hi Janet.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Janet is a PR coach for experts, businesses and brands, an author and a podcaster. Her latest book is Your Press Release is Breaking My Heart, a totally unconventional guide to selling your story in the media. Now, we are all super interested in this topic, Janet, and I think we're just going to jump straight in. So I wanted to start with a definition because I think people are confused. What is PR? Why is it different to advertising and other kinds of marketing?
Okay, it's a really good question to start with because when I first started helping people with this, I didn't explain it. And I often used to find out I've been working with someone for a few weeks or a few months and realize that they weren't actually sure what it was. They wanted PR, but they didn't know what it was. So it's a really, really good question. So essentially, PR is free coverage in magazines, newspapers, and on radio and TV. And I think where people get a little bit confused is obviously you can buy adverts in magazines and newspapers, you can buy editorial, you can even buy time on radio and TV, but this is free, credible editorial. So that means that content that journalists want to create because they think it would be really great for their audience rather than content that you're paying them to create.
Wow, that's really interesting. And you used the phrase creditable editorial, which sounds amazing. What are some examples of what is credible editorial? Because you know we're in this space where there's so many online magazines or whatever. What is credible?
Well, it really depends on what the publication is. So it's what that audience for publication are interested in reading. But, you know, it's essentially every editor will have an idea of what their audience wants to hear about, what they will find stimulating, what they want to talk about with their friends. And increasingly, it's very much driven by what online stuff and whether it's shareable and people are going to talk about it on social media. You know, but for example, I mean, I've done quite a bit of editing over the years. I've worked quite a lot on The Guardian. I mean, I'll give you an example. I worked on the Guardian Small Business Network. And the kind of things that we're looking for there would be very different than you'd be looking for on a business section somewhere else. So, for example, we'd be looking at really practical how-to articles that are going to help small business owners to really kind of ramp up their business. But then if you look at, say, the business section on the Times, they're probably going to be looking at more kind of financial news. So does that kind of give you an idea?
Yeah, I think so. And like you say, it's going to be different by country. You know, in the UK, The Guardian would be great. Some Americans would be like, yeah, I just don't even care about that, whatever. So that's really cool. So then I wanted to, you know, coming to the specifics of authors. So for us right now, something like BookBub, which is an, you know, a paid email list, or Facebook ads, which you directly pay for, you pay for them and they are measurable in terms of book sales. Now, and this is kind of my biggest issue around PR, so I think we've got to address it straight up. Why should authors even consider PR when the results are not measurable, are they? Like, I've been on TV and that I can't tell how many people discovered me because I was on this particular TV show. So why should authors do PR?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question and definitely one worth asking. So the way I look at it, there's two ways that PR can help you if you're an author. So the first way is building credibility. So when you go to my website, now at the moment you don't because I've just published a book, so I've got something different on there. But generally, when you go to my website, you will see across the top that I've got as featured in The Guardian, Entrepreneur, Huffington Post, BBC, all these kind of credible titles. And that kind of gives you a stamp of approval. And I think for people who want to engage with you, might be reading your books, it might be if you offer other services, they might want to work with you in another way, then it's almost like, well, you know, if the BBC think that they're, you know, they know what they're talking about, and the New York Times think they know what they're talking about, then they must do. Now, we all know that's not necessarily true, but it's like a stamp of approval, basically, you know, that it's kind of credibility. And if you're looking to maybe get speaking gigs, or you're looking to attract, maybe you're indie published, and you're looking to maybe attract a traditional publisher, then all of this stuff is going to help, because it gives you credibility. And the other thing that's just worth mentioning actually quickly for authors is that often when you put a book proposal out, the first thing that a traditional publisher would want to know is, well, how are you going to publicize this book? Who is your audience? You know, how do we know that you can do this? But obviously, as an author, if you've already got this great coverage on some really high profile influential titles, then obviously you're proving that. It's like social proof. The other side of it can actually lead to sales. Now, this is more complicated because, as you say, you know, it's very difficult to measure the return on investment. I think that's true of, apart from like Facebook advertising, or, you know, it's true of lots of stuff that you do in your business. isn't it? You know, people need 8 touch points with you or something. What's the sales research? They need touch points with you. And PR can be one of those touch points. So it may be that they read something that, you know, you've had a feature in the New York Times or mention or something, but then they also see you on Twitter, and then, I don't know, a Facebook ad pops up or whatever. So it can actually be a cumulative effect of, you know, many different touch points, and PR is just one part of it. But, you know, for example, when I was doing the book PR for, now I've just published, indie published a non-fiction book, which is about how to get PR. And when I was doing my PR, I knew that the national press wouldn't be interested in doing a story about my book, which is essentially aimed at, you know, business owners and consultants and authors who want to do their own PR. But I was kind of aware that, you know, there were opportunities for me to get coverage. So I wrote an opinion article for PR Week, which is the industry title for the PR industry, because I do also have some people who work in the industry who read my stuff as well. And that particular piece of coverage in PR Week led to an inquiry. We're just firming up the details, but it was actually worth thousands of pounds in terms of consultancy. Mm. So I could actually trace that piece back. I've also written a piece for The Guardian about how to write press releases, and that sent me like tons and tons of traffic and tons of potential clients as well. So it can be tricky, but you can measure it at times, and there are ways you can measure your return on investment. But I think it's a little bit like social media. It can be, sometimes it can be clear, and sometimes it's about looking at the overall picture of what you've been doing overall in your PR and marketing, if that kind of makes sense.
Well, there's so much I can come back on that. I think we're going to get into the kind of the targeting as we go through. So I guess let's come back on the success with PR and the multiple touch points, because that's what it seems like for me when I think about getting PR. So I've been on the BBC and all that type of thing, and they found me. So this is the other point. What are the things around being found? Because you mentioned writing an article, for example, and pitching, and we're going to come back to pitching in a minute. But what are the things that authors can do in order to be found by the media when they're looking for people to write a story? So, for example, I got a call, like it was January the 4th or something, a couple of years ago, from Sky News. They wanted a story on career change, on leaving your job, and they Googled and they just found me and called me, and I went on TV like the next morning at 5 a.m. So how can authors get found without having to pitch? And then we'll come back to pitching.
Well, there's some really simple things that you can do on your social media. Basically, you need to know that journalists are desperate to find experts to comment on stuff, and they are actively looking. So that should be reassuring. So they're often looking on places like Twitter and on LinkedIn. Now, I still practice as a journalist. I've just spent a couple of weeks covering for an editor at The Guardian, so I've been doing this myself. And so basically they're looking for keywords. You know, like happened to you, they were Googling. It might be on Twitter, it might be on LinkedIn. But what I find a lot of people do is they don't sort of do the basics, like, for example, make sure that their Twitter profile really explains what they do in simple terms. They don't have a phone number on there. Now, some people might say, oh, well, I don't want to have my phone number on there. But, you know, journalists don't work 9 to 5 hours. You know, the likelihood is they're going to be looking for somebody to help them at, you know, 9 o'clock at night or 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And you could be that person that they come to. But if they, I mean, I've got a big problem with contact forms. That's probably a whole other thing. Mm. But if they go to your website and they think, oh, she seems interesting, or he seems interesting, and then they've got to fill out a contact form, that's probably an immediate, like, oh, you know, it just slows them down. But if you've got on your Twitter profile, for example, your phone number, and I've got a real example of this, a lady that I've been working with recently, she's actually a consultant, but she's an author as well, and a BBC journalist for, I think it was Radio 5 Live, they were looking for somebody to talk on her topic of expertise, and because on Twitter she had her phone number, this is a little tweak, she'd come to one of my webinars and I just suggested this little tweak that she made, she got on 5 Live and also I think on Radio 4 as well. And just that small tweak, just having your phone number on there, and things like on your LinkedIn profile, just making sure it's really clear what you do, which sounds a bit silly, but sometimes people kind of put these kind of like really jargony titles, and actually, you know, if you're a thriller writer, and you know, that's what you need to put, and sometimes I think people can kind of forget their audience
Yeah, it's so funny you mentioned the contact forms, because I agonized over this, and I do have a contact form on the creativepen.com, which goes to my VA. And then she checks that email, you know, a couple of times a week, and which means that I missed a Wired article because it came through too late. And I was actually really annoyed about that. But because I get so much spammy email, I can't not have a form, and it cut down on a whole load of other stuff. So as you're saying that, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, so what should I do? So is it that I should have a separate press page? And I used to have one, and then I kind of stopped doing it as a separate page. But should authors have a specific page for the press? Like, would a journalist look at that with details on, and what should go on that page?
Yeah, I mean, I find a lot of people sort of wasting time and money creating like media kits. All you need is on your about page, your contact page, that people have the key things. So a phone number. Now, I know this might make you feel a bit uncomfortable, but it doesn't have to be your personal phone number. It could just be a answer service or something, but basically where you can get a message to you, you know, quickly. So it could be a phone number. You need a photo, some good quality photos of you. Ideally, you know, a selection, not maybe just headshots, but maybe things that tell the story of your business. So they've got a selection to choose from, or your book, in fact, depending on what you do. And also some biogs. And I notice that you have different lengths, you know, so you have a 50-word one, a 100-word one, and 100-word one, and they're the kind of things that journalists are going to be looking for. And also maybe just links to a few other articles that you've been quoted in. When I'm working as an editor, the first thing I do, if someone gets in touch and they want to write something for me, or they want to be featured, the first thing I do is Google them and see what they've done before. And basically, if it's writing, I mean, with an author, you would kind of expect that they can string a sentence together, but there's a big difference between being able to write for the media and writing fiction. And actually, sometimes fiction writers can be like the worst people, because they're very elaborate, and they, you know, and obviously when you're writing for the media, it's a lot more punchy, and you know, you would use like, you know, two words rather than 20. And yeah, I mean, that is the essentials of good writing, but I've noticed that often fiction writers can be a little bit more kind of verbose. And so what you're looking at is, if they've got some examples of their writing and you can see that they can string a sentence together and you're not going to have to edit it too much, then you know, that's going to make you happy. And basically, journalists just want to make their life easier, like we all do. They want to do it, you know, they want to find stuff quickly, and they just want to be able to get on with their job.
Yeah, and it, coming back to the profiles and things, like, it's funny you mentioned LinkedIn. I am shocking with LinkedIn, because I used to use it in my corporate life, so I kind of have this aversion to LinkedIn because it represents my old life, whereas I really just need to update it. But the kind of SEO, the right words to use, search engine optimization around words, like I would, like many people would use the word author or podcaster, for example. So what are some better, you know, what are some examples that would be better than just author on your Twitter profile? Or instead of using something witty, I've noticed that many people use witty words. You know, how exact do they need to be?
I think just being really Ron Seal. So for those people who are not from the UK, like, Ron Seal is this brand of paint, and there used to be some kind of advert or something, didn't it? It was like Ron Seal, what it says on the tin. But I think the more simple you can be and direct, and the less clever you can be, basically, the more helpful it's going to be. So if you are a thriller author or a crime author, that's what you need to say. So if a journalist is looking for a thriller author to comment on something, or a murder mystery writer or whatever, you know, you want to come up first in search. And if you put some kind of, like, you know, really clever pun or something, they're not going to find you. And the other thing to say as well for LinkedIn is, obviously, going for radio and TV stuff, have some video on there as well. So radio and TV researchers, you know, they're not looking for perfection, but, you know, even just something like this, just see that you're not going to freeze up in front of a camera, and that you're lively, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. A little bit of film, a little bit example of your writing. So just, it doesn't have to mean, I have to say, I don't like LinkedIn very much either. And but just making sure that your profile is up to date, and that you're going to come up first in search, basically. And it is just really just thinking really basics. A journalist is not going to be searching for, you know, multimedia thriller, dystopian, blah blah blah. You know, that they're going to be looking for, you know, just like thriller writer or whatever. Or fiction expert or whatever. So to just use those terms, really.
And if you're writing nonfiction around a theme, you would include, you know, those specific words. Which is, and it's another reason why having multiple, and it is very annoying having multiple brands. So I have JF Pen, which is my fiction, and Joanna Pen, which is my nonfiction, and I have two different names, two different websites, but I still haven't really split my social media. Mm. And as you're speaking, I'm like, oh, you know, and I've been thinking I really need to sort out JF Penn as a separate entity in social media. And I have a different Facebook page, but it's so important when it comes to this, because you have, as soon as you Google someone, you land on a page, you make a decision quite quickly, don't you, as to whether or not you want to talk to them.
Yeah, definitely. And I have this conversation with my clients all the time about specialising, and people are so scared of specialising, and they're so scared to be pigeonholed, and they say, I don't want people to pigeonhole me. But actually, you know, journalists in particular, they're really busy people, and they're just looking for that go-to person. So, you know, they're not interested in the fact that, you know, you're a thriller writer, but you've also written non-fiction about surfing or whatever. You know, you need to find a way that basically you can make yourself the go-to person that comes up in search for whatever it is that is most important to you to get out there. So sometimes it means making a few decisions about what you're going to prioritize. And it might be that you prioritize different things at different times. You know, it might be that you're trying to push a nonfiction book for a while, so, you know, you change some of your profiles to reflect that. And when you're back in the fiction writings, I know that lots of your audience kind of do both, and then you're back in the fiction, you might change things around. So it's just about kind of just always asking yourself that question, you know, if a journalist was looking for somebody to help with this, you know, would they be able to find me? And, you know, what do I need to change so that they can find me more easily?
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to cover that first is because I know most people hate pitching, but you can avoid pitching by making yourself findable, which is fantastic. But now let's talk about pitching. So basically, and I'm sorry for anyone, you know, listening who still feels this way, but nobody cares that you have a book, right? Nobody actually cares. And in fact, when you're a journalist, everyone has a blooming book. Like, seriously, you get pitched every day, right? People with books. So how can an author who wants to get PR come up with a story that a journalist would even be interested in? Because so many people pay for these press release things that just go out and say, here's my book, which is pointless. So what is the angle to come up with?
Okay, well, there's lots of different things that you can do. So what I always advise people to do is look around the edges, because I often work with business owners, so I say look around the edges of your business. So in the case of authors, I'd say look around the edges of your book and your writing. So look at the areas of your life which intersect with your book and your writing, and that's often where the stories are. So when I'm working with people, I have this kind of handout that I use with them, and I can share it actually with your audience if you think they find it useful. And basically it's got, like, in the middle it's got, you know, your brand or your book or your product or whatever it is, and then around the side it's got work, relationships and friendships, life and death, money, and it's got all these kind of areas of your life which intersect with your business. And that's basically what journalists are far more interested in, is those areas. And often, so I'll come to back to that in a second, but the other thing is often that we all have, I say in business that people have a business story, but I think people often have a book story as well. So they have a story behind why they write what they write. And, you know, I mean, you've got some great stories around what you do, you know, leaving your job and going minimalist and moving to another part of the country so that you could work solely as a writer, and, you know, being unhappy in your job. And I heard you talking on another podcast about getting divorced in your 20s. You know, my goodness, brain clocked that as well, because I was like, you know, so all those things that have happened in your life are often, and how they relate to your book, are often far more interesting to journalists. So I get really clear on kind of what your book story is. And to give you a few examples, so I mean, I'm always kind of, I'm always quite interested to see authors how they PR their books. But the Adele Parks, who is a, you know, a quite popular chick lit author, what I've noticed about her when she has a new book out, she always appears in the Daily Mail with some story from her life which links to the theme of her book. So I've seen her write stuff about how she was proposed to 8 times, and that particular, I think it was 8 times, it was a lot, and related to the theme of her, you know, the theme of her current book. And it was basically a nice read. It was a great story and had nothing to do with her book on the face of it, but at the end it just had Adele Parks' new book is out and blah blah blah. When you thought about the theme, they were quite linked. She had another one, I think, about why she has only got one child and why she chose not to do that. I think I saw that in The Guardian, I think it was. I've also seen her, what else have I seen her do? It's the proposal one. Her friend, best friend divorcing her. I saw a piece that she'd written about that, and that kind of linked to the theme of her book. And that's what journalists are interested in. They're interested in the human human story. So it's basically trying to find, I mean, that's one way. There's other things that I can mention as well, but for fiction authors, I think it works particularly well. That can work really well. And also, you know, I was listening to a podcast episode with Claire McIntosh, who's she's got that really kind of amazing thriller, and she's doing really, really, really well. And I know that her story is she lost a child, and I heard her talking on a podcast about how losing that child kind of inspired her to become an author and inspired some of the themes in her book. And I think when you're a fiction writer, the things that you end up writing about, I haven't published any fiction, but from working with writers and interviewing lots of writers, I think often the that come up in their fiction often do link to their lives. So they've often got stories, you know, things that have happened to them in lives which come out in different ways in their books. So it's about kind of finding those stories that journalists will be interested in, and then you go to them and say, look, you know, I've got you know this really strong personal story, would you be interested in doing this? And by the way, I've also got a book out. So it's almost like you turn it upside down and you go with the story, and then you know, if you can sell them a really, you know, compelling story, then they will be, you know, normally happy to give a plug for your book at the end. And if you look at in the UK, we have the Guardian, which is obviously one of our biggest selling newspapers, and also internationally online, and they have a family section on a Saturday. And what I've noticed about that section is often they have a really compelling personal story, you know, around a kind of family issue, you know, maybe long lost relatives, or they have, I don't know, 30s and 40s or something like that, you know, somebody who's had a child in each decade, something like that. And then when you look at the end, they've usually got some kind of book out. So it is about finding those personal stories and hooking editors in with those, and that will get you the plug for your book. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, now I'm thinking, oh, how can I tie in, you know, sort of murders and explosions and all that type of thing. And I guess, yeah, it is about really sitting down and thinking about those human issues. And at the end of the day, writing fiction, people are interested in people. And yeah. So that's why character is so important when you write fiction. The plot is kind of secondary, the character's first. So what you're basically saying is you as an author have to be a character in the story that the PR person is interested in. And I think that's quite hard for a lot of people, you know, myself included. You don't necessarily want that attention on you personally. You'd rather have the attention on your book, but like we just said, nobody cares. Yeah. And so hopefully that will give people some good ideas. Mm. Now, okay, so say they come up with some ideas, how do they know who to pitch? Because I think this is such an important part, isn't it? How do they, because you can't just, there's no point in just sending your story just randomly to a paper or a TV show. So how do you find the right people for your story?
Okay, well, there's a process that I take my clients through. So the first thing I would do is say, well, who is it you want to get in front of? So basically, you know, if you're romantic fiction, or you've got a non-fiction book about, you know, getting PR for your business or your book or whatever, then who is it you need to get in front of? Who do you, you know, what is your objective? And usually it's to sell books. So you know, where are the potential readers of your book? You know, what are they reading, watching, and listening to, and all the rest of it? So you really need to get clear about what is it you're trying to do, and who you need to get in front of to make that happen. Because I see people who chase coverage in big publications, you know, they must get in the New York Times, or I want to be in the Sydney Morning Herald or whatever, but actually, will that get you in front of the people that you want to read your book? And particularly if you've written like a niche non-fiction title, it might not be the best place for you to be. You know, it might be better for you to be in some kind of industry title that people haven't heard of. So that would be the first step, is like, you know, what is your objective? Presumably in most cases with books, it is to sell more books. So who do you need to get in front of to sell those books, and what do they read, watch, and listen to? And people often say to me at that point, well, how do I find out? Well, you know, just ask people. So find, you know, 5, 10, 15 people who are your, you know, ideal readers, and just ask them. And just bear in mind that people don't always tell you the truth. So like, for example, everybody says in the UK they don't read the Daily Mail, and most people do, and they love it, but they will tell you that they read all these highbrow things.
Yeah, that's like people reading, you know, saying they've read literary fiction, but actually they're reading romance on their Kindle.
Exactly, yeah. And so just bear in mind, you know, you have to have a sort of, take it with a slight pinch of salt, but you will get a sort of general sense of what people people are reading, what they engage with. And there really is your, you know, where you need to go. So when I was publishing my book recently, my nonfiction book on how to get press coverage, like a DIY book, how to get press coverage, I knew there was no way that the Nationals were going to be interested in that, or not in the sense, or not in, you know, not in just writing about it. You know, I just knew it wouldn't be of interest. So I did several things. So I wrote this opinion piece for PR Week about why, or pitched this opinion piece about why all people who work in the PR industry should spend some time in a newsroom. And, you know, that's a kind of quite a sort of controversial question. I wrote a kind of very practical how-to piece for The Guardian on how to get press coverage, or some kind of aspect of it. So once you've kind of really kind of where you need to be and who you need to get in front of, then the idea starts to roll, and then you can actually go beyond that personal story, because you've then got, you know, it might be that there's some themes in your book, or there's something that you know about, you're expert in, that would lend itself really well to an opinion article like the one that I mentioned. Or it may well be, and this is another thing I encourage people to do, is there's things that you could teach people. So, you know, for example, actually, I had an author who posted in my Facebook group earlier on, who was saying that she'd got some publicity in a writing magazine, I think, for one of her books that had come out, and she was teaching something around the sort of self-publishing process or something like that. So once you kind of, it really is about kind of identifying where you need to be and what those publications are, then really, really researching them and seeing not what is the story I want to tell, because the story we all want to tell is how brilliant we are and how brilliant our book is. But instead of that, is like, what is the story people actually want to hear? And like I said at the beginning, that will differ depending on the kind of publications that you've identified. So, you know, if you've got a short list of, you know, you think, well, you know, my readers, potential readers, they read The Guardian, The Huffington Post, the, I don't know, Cosmopolitan magazine, you know, then it really is about rolling your sleeves up. And as one of my colleagues used to say, newspaper colleagues, just getting your fingers grubby and actually sitting down with those publications or looking at them online and actually looking at what kind of content do they actually run, not what would I like them to run, what do they actually run. And then you start to think, oh, look, well, that's interesting, because, you know, they have a first person, a very powerful first person story every Saturday. I wonder if, you know, that story about the time I nearly died could work. You know, I'm being very flippant here, but, you know, it really is about like fitting. I sometimes think it's like a, you know, one of those children's shape sort of toys, you know, when you put the square peg in the square bit and the round bit. It's a bit like that. So once you start to look at publications like that, and you start to think, okay, well, they have that regular bit there, and maybe that thing that happened to me there. Oh, and, you know, in that they have sort of, you know, really I'll do stuff, you know, about fly fishing, and I could suggest an article, you know, six bits of tackle you need. It's about really sort of looking at, you know, what they cover and where you can fit in, which is a very different place than most people come at it, like from a kind of like me, you know.
Yeah, and then just pitching what they have. So funny when you said how you almost died. I did almost die in Bali. I had a wheatgrass shot, and it turns out I'm allergic to, and I almost died of a wheatgrass shot at a yoga retreat in Bali, which has got to be a super story. I mean, I've got to use that. So now I'm going to find somewhere to pitch that one.
No, definitely.
And it's funny because it's got nothing to do with my books. But what you're saying is that doesn't matter. At the end, it can you just want people to think, oh, that's interesting. And then they'll see at the end that you have a book, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm. And also, you know, I mean, I always encourage people to try, if there's a way that you can try and mold what you do into it. So, for example, you know, one of my clients, when I started working with him, he was a coach, actually. He's a relationship coach. And I said to him, what inspired you to do what you do? Why do you work with couples? And he said, well, because my parents have been really unhappily married for the whole of their life, and they've just got divorced in their 80s. And I was like, oh my God, I really want to read that story. But, you know, it wasn't just about that being a great story that I wanted to read. And incidentally, that piece appeared in The Guardian and also in the Daily Mail's You magazine as well. But it was like, you know, it really was relevant to his work that he was doing, because it made him want to work with couples and help them save their marriages. And, you know, so, you know, often there's usually a way that you can make it relevant to what you do. Like, it's,
yeah.
You know, so I'm sure there probably would be a way that you could at least mention in there that you were a writer or something.
Yeah,
you know,
I was on writing retreat, but yes. just come. So taking that further, so people have found that they could pitch this particular thing. Do they then find the name of the journalist, and then they try and get the journalist's contact details and target like one or two specific people rather than just scattergun?
Yes. So this is where some, you know, people go wrong. They just kind of think, oh, okay, you know, I found this magazine, let's just send it to the editor. And actually, in reality, the editor of a magazine or newspaper probably doesn't do so much of the data commissioning, we call it. So you'll probably find that there will be, then it's kind of like you find the section editor that you want. So example, I just mentioned that was the family section of The Guardian. So Graham had sort of realised that there was a section that carried that kind of content. So he's like, right, now I need to find out the name of the... Well, I told him because I knew. But, you know, if you try and find out the name of that particular person. And then you really need to get it in front of the person who can make a decision. And it's a bit like when you're pitching a book proposal or something. You know, you don't want to just send, you know, if you're trying to get a particular agent to work with you, you send it to that person. You know, you don't just send it generically and hope that it will land on the right person's desk. You need to find the person. Twitter is brilliant for finding journalists contact, you know, for finding journalists. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would recommend that people do, so say for example you've decided, you know, that you've got a hit list and, you know, I don't know, it's the New York Times or whatever, and there's a particular section you'd really love to get in, then find out who the editor is and basically kind of stalk them on Twitter for a while and just have a look at what they're sharing, what they're talking about. Maybe you could just start replying to a few tweets or whatever and just kind of warm them up a little bit. And that can be one way so that when your pitch does land, it's not entirely cold. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, make sure you're not being too stalkery or whatever, but that can, yeah, and it's all out there. Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, and sometimes people get, you can buy lists of journalists' email addresses, but I just think it's a bit of a waste of money, because I think you can find most people you need to connect with within about 3 or 4 clicks. So why would you spend money on lists that are probably out of date? Sometimes you'll find the right person and then you'll get an out of office that says they're on maternity leave or something like that. And
yeah.
So, you know, if you want to get, you know, and I'll just pick up the phone. That's what I often say to people. So just pick up the phone and just ask, you know, and you might get passed around a little bit and you might get people who are a bit short with you because, you know, newspapers in particular are quite busy places. But, you know, who cares? That's the worst that could happen. And, you know, you've got the name of the person you want to get in front of. And that really often is half the battle. When I see people not getting responses and getting despondent, it's often because they're sending it to the wrong person or they're making the cardinal sin of sending it to something like, if you rang up The Guardian and said, you know, I've got a feature idea, they probably tell you to send it to features@theguardian.com.
Yeah, and it would just go in a spam box somewhere.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it really is about trying to find that person and make a relationship. And, you know, like with, you know, I run events in London every month where I get just to come talk about what they're looking for. And just finding out where journalists are seeking to meet them. And if there's somebody that you'd really like to start, you know, engaging with, or you'd like to write for them, then find out where they're speaking. You know, they're often speaking at events or they might be at trade shows, whatever it might be. It's like anything else that you're doing, you know, in your marketing and PR, you just got to hustle a bit.
Yes. And I know people listening have got excited and then you started saying things like make a phone call. And
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, because, well, for me, as a, you know, I'm an introvert and I hate phone calls. Like, it's probably my number one issue. I never answer the phone. You know, I just don't like phone calls. And one of the reasons I do podcasting is actually so I still have to call someone and it still gives me, like, you know, sweaty palms. I've been doing this for years. And so for me, that's the big issue with PR, is this follow-up, because everyone says, oh, even if you email, you should follow up again, you should, you know, like you just said, pick up the phone or something. Now, I'm fine if the contact has been made, if there's been a warm-up, but this sort of cold phone calls is my utter nightmare. And also in terms of time, I guess, but let's just stick with the introvert thing. You know, do you have any tips, I guess, for people who struggle with this following up and reaching out?
Well, the good news is that you probably won't have to phone because most journalists hate getting phone calls too, so it's fine. But if you had a story that was really timely, so say for example, so you said you would almost died after drinking, was it wheatgrass or something?
Yeah, wheatgrass shot, yeah.
So let's just say that after we got off this call, you went onto the BBC website and you saw that a tourist, you know, was in trouble or was dying or something. It sounds terrible, doesn't it? Like, I mean, flippant, but this is kind of how reporters think. You saw that, or maybe a gang of school children or, you know, had drunk some wheatgrass and they were all desperately ill. I would say to you, you need to get on the phone and, you know, like, you know,
jump
make yourself
on it.
Known,
yeah,
you know, and jump on it. So in that kind of situation, when it's a really hot story and, you know, you're the only person that can, you know, help, definitely just get on the phone. But most of the time, journalists don't answer their phone either, and they're not interested. So they operate in email. So I would say, first of all, don't too much about it. And if it's like getting contact details, or that's the kind of thing you get, or an assistant, you know, to ring up someone who doesn't mind ringing up, and, you know, if you don't like doing it. So I wouldn't, I've actually written a blog post, which is actually, you know, how to do PR if you're an introvert, which you, if you want to link to, you can do, because it's such a problem. So you might find that useful. And I think the chasing up thing is you can usually do most of it by email. And if you do have to get on the phone, just a few key things. So I was covering for an editor at The Guardian the last few weeks. So I always pick up the phone because obviously I have a business where I teach people how to get in the media. And I want to understand, you know, what people are finding hard and what making mistakes with. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to answer the phone. So I was picking up the phone. And the first mistake people do is they immediately, if you imagine you're a journalist and, you know, your audience will know this. So you're writing, you're deep in thought, you're just thinking about, you know, how you're going to get from A to B when you're writing. The phone goes, you pick it up, and there's somebody who is just babbling on at you, and you don't actually understand what they're saying because you're like, I was just doing something else and now you're talking at me. And so when people say journalists can be a bit rude, often that, you know, they're literally just, they've had their head in something else and their new phone, and people get so nervous, they just vomit over them. So I've had that thing where I've picked up the phone and people are just like, talking at me. They haven't asked me if I've got time to talk. They haven't. So if you do have to phone, I would just ring up and say something like, you know, it's Joanna here. I'm the author of whatever book it is. And I just wondered if you had time to talk through a story idea. And so basically you're giving them a bait that you've actually got something useful for them. You know, you've got a story idea and that will show you know what you're talking about. And some people say, oh, don't ask, because then they'll probably say no. Lots of journalists do say, I haven't got any time. But actually, if someone said that to me, I would probably go, yeah, you know, I've only got a minute, but yeah, go on. And then they'll, and if you can just get your idea in the first, you know, in the first bit, that you don't ramble or waffle. And by asking if they've got time to talk, it also slows you down as well, because you say, have you got
you
a minute?
Take a breath.
Yeah, and it actually forces you to say. And then just sort of saying, you know, instead of kind of rambling on about who you are and your background, just saying, you know, I noticed the story about the tourists who wheatgrass, you know, and are really poorly. That happened to me last year. I just, you know, if you're doing anything on it, that really is your pitch, you know, like you don't need to do anything more than that. And I don't need to be polished or have a script or anything like that. It's just being able to get to the point quickly, I think. That's the bit that journalists have, and just treat it like a conversation. I think often people have this idea of journalists who, they're in the kind of office and they're kind of like swanning around like these powerful people saying yes or no. But actually it can be quite scary when you're an editor, because you've got pages to fill, or you've been told you've got to commission, if it's online, you've got to commission so many stories, or, you know, on radio and TV, you've got airspace to fill. And sometimes you just can't find that story. And I've literally been, you know, close to tears, because I know my editor's coming back from holiday and has told me I have to have a story or whatever. I just can't find anything. And so just telling yourself that you're not a pest, you're actually potentially solving a problem. So you're potentially, you know, helping
useful.
Them to get home early. Well, you are, you know, every email that you send, every phone call you make, you're potentially solving a problem, helping them go home earlier, fill some space, get their boss off the back, or whatever. And I think often people approach this sort of thing feeling like they're a pest and they're being annoying, but actually I could just hug, you know, people send, you know, you'll notice if any of your listeners have ever done any of PR, you know, pitching into the media, you'll notice something about journalists that they'll ignore you, but the minute they want something, they'll be on the phone, like, and phoning you every 5 seconds, you know, like, oh, have you got this yet, or can we have that photo or whatever. And so I think just remembering that you could potentially be solving a problem, and you know, helping them out is a much better way to think of it than this kind of scary pitching thing.
Wow, I could talk to you all day, but we are pretty much out of time. So tell everybody about your book. Your press release is breaking my heart. What else can they find in there?
So my book, as the title would suggest, was inspired by the fact that as a journalist, I've spent 15 years working as a national journalist and just seeing so many dreadful press releases come into my inbox. So the subtitle is An Unconventional Way to Tell Your Story in the Media, a totally unconventional way. So basically I take people through everything they need to know to do coverage. So I start right at the beginning with what I call the low-hanging fruits, the stuff that you can do that doesn't involve pitching, that involve press releases or phoning anyone up. So I teach you some really simple stuff that everybody can do just online. And then we progress to, you know, how to find story ideas, how to put a pitch together, how to chase up a journalist and what to do if you haven't heard back. And I've also got some other sort of bonus bits in there about getting speaking gigs and other things like that. And I've also created some resources as well. So for each chapter, there's a downloadable resource that you can go, I use Teachable to host it, you can go over and download that. So yeah, it's basically everything you need to know to get started with your own PR. And you know, I've been doing it, it's from my point of view as a journalist, and all things that I've learned dealing with people pitching and hearing their pitches over the phone and seeing their press releases, and you know, so you couldn't get more sort of genuine, you know, in terms of, you know, and I genuinely want to help people because I've been a small business owner myself for years, and the book really was inspired by often seeing small business owners or authors or consultants or people who maybe didn't have a massive budget spending out on PR companies and thinking, no, you could be doing it yourself and you could be doing a much better job. So that's brilliant. It in a nutshell.
No, fantastic. So where can people find you and your book and your blog and your podcast online?
So I'm at janetmurray.co.uk. My podcast is the Soulful PR Podcast. And online, I generally hang out most on Twitter, which is @Jan_Murray. But I've also got a really fabulous Facebook group called the Soulful PR Facebook Community. I've got a couple of thousand people in there who are in there every day sharing ideas and tips and contacts. And that's really a great place to start.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Janet. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.